You know, the other day I took some of my boys to the dentist, and while we were in the waiting room, they were kind of messing around, hitting each other, and they weren't being bad. They're just having fun. And one of the dental hygienists walked by and said, "Ah, brotherly love." And there's a special relationship between brothers, isn't there? There are 10 unique brotherly relationships in our household. And so I was very interested in the story about the deep love and betrayal and admiration and joy and dysfunction between two brothers growing up in Chicago in the 1950s. Theodore and David were raised by loving parents of Polish descent who taught them the value of hard work and education. Theodore was 7 years older than David, but despite the age difference, they grew up very close. And Theodore was very kind to David. David recalled one time when he was little, when Theodore built an ingenious device using strings and levers to help him reach a high door handle. By all accounts, Theodore was brilliant, and David was no slouch either. They would both go on to attend Ivy League universities, but Theodore also taught his younger brother compassion. Theodore was unusually sensitive, especially when it came to animals. One time, the neighborhood boys caught a baby bunny, and everyone crowded in to gawk at the helpless, shivering creature. And Theodore was appalled by how they were using this poor, helpless creature for their own entertainment, and he convinced them to let the rabbit go. But Theodore struggled to connect with people. David asked his mother about it once, and she attributed it to Theodore's the time when Theodore was 9 months old, and he had to be isolated at a hospital because of a rash. And she said that Theodore was never quite the same after that, and his mother believed that he had abandonment issues as a result. Theodore graduated high school at age 15, and when he went off to Harvard for the first time, his younger brother David could not have been prouder. He wanted to someday go to Harvard, just like his older brother, but he'd have to settle for a degree in social work from Columbia. Theodore went on to get his doctorate in mathematics, and his dissertation was so brilliant that one of the advisors on his committee mused that only a dozen or so people in the country would truly be able to appreciate it. But Theodore's time in university was not without its trials. He was described by his peers as affable once you got to know him, but he tended to be quite closed off to the rest of the hall, especially since he was so young when he started. And there were also the experiments. Psychological testing was not regulated very closely back then, and for years a professor named Dr. Henry Murray subjected Theodore to a series of unethical experiments. The unwitting subject would be asked to write essays detailing his personal convictions or beliefs, only for those intimate details to be used against him for a later session when an experimenter would verbally berate and belittle him. There's good evidence to believe that Dr. Murray was working with the CIA's infamous Project MKUltra, where human guinea pigs were illegally and unwittingly subjected to extreme emotional stress, abuse, and even psychedelic drugs in an attempt to find ways to control their minds. This travesty was recently declassified by the United States government, and it undercut the Americans' trust and confidence in the country's intelligence gathering services. But Theodore moved on, and he and his younger brother David became quite close in adulthood. David was thrilled as Theodore started treating him as an equal and not as just an annoying little brother. And both brothers had a deep love of nature, and they're quite suspicious of modern technology, so they would take time off work and go camping deep into the wilderness. David recalls that one night as they were laying in their sleeping bags under a starry sky that he and his older brother he told his older brother that he was homesick and that he couldn't wait to get back. But Theodore felt just the opposite. He wanted to stay out in the wilderness forever, so great was his disdain for modern society. David would go on to get married and settle down into comfortable modern life, but Theodore became more and more detached from society. In 1969, he abruptly quit his job at the University of California, Berkeley, renouncing all technology, and he moved into the wilderness of Montana, where he built his own cabin and lived off the land. And it was this difference that strained the brothers' relationship. Theodore felt betrayed by David's retreat into suburban life, and he expressed his disgust in a series of angry letters before he cut off all correspondence with family and friends. He was especially angry about the housing developments that were infringing upon his serene little cabin. And when the government built a highway through his favorite valley, he became enraged. So while Theodore was living off the land, David was enjoying life with his loving wife, Linda, and taking care of his widowed mother, Wanda. Over the years, David occasionally worried about his recluse brother, and his mother fretted about him constantly, but for the most part, life was good for the younger brother. But life for David would be thrown into turmoil through a series of extremely difficult, yet crucial conversations that he had to endure in the spring of 1996. Isn't it amazing how our lives are often dramatically changed for the good or for the bad through crucial, critical conversations? One day, Linda sat David down and told him that she had been agonizing over a difficult conversation that the two of them desperately needed to have. You see, since the 1970s, people had been terrorized by packaged bombs that were sent to universities and airlines that were maiming and killing people. Law enforcement was baffled. There seemed to be no motive, and the bomb maker was careful to leave no evidence behind. And people were scared. If the bomb that had been placed in the cargo hold of American Airlines Flight 444 had not malfunctioned, it would have torn the plane apart. The FBI connected the university bombings with the airline bombings and nicknamed the terrorist the Unabomber. The hunt for the Unabomber would become the longest and most expensive investigation in the history of the FBI. And in a move of desperation, the FBI asked the New York Times to publish the manifesto sent by the Unabomber in hopes of someone being able to identify him. Well, Linda Kaczynski read the Times, and she was struck by the similarities between the Unabomber's manifesto and the angry letters her husband had been receiving from her older brother, Theodore. How do you tell your husband that you think the man he had idolized for most of his life was really a domestic terrorist? David, has it ever occurred to you, even as a remote possibility, that your brother might be the Unabomber? She asked her husband. David was floored, angry, and defensive. How could she believe such a thing about his brother? Sure, Theodore was a little out there, but he had never been violent. A week later, David read the manifesto for himself in order to disprove his wife's ridiculous notion. But from the very first paragraph, he knew. The wording and phrasing in the manifesto sounded just like his brother's. So David was faced with an impossible dilemma. How could he stay silent and allow Ted to continue hurting people? Yet how could he turn in his own brother? He had seen how the government dealt with these kind of things, and he was worried that Ted would be killed. The FBI had botched the arrest at Ruby Ridge, and people died. The Branch Davidian compound in Waco was burned to the ground with innocent women and children inside. But David knew that he couldn't allow his brother to continue hurting people. He needed to have that difficult yet critical conversation with law enforcement. So he hired a lawyer to negotiate with the FBI. The lawyer contacted the FBI and told them that his yet-to-be-named client knew the identity and location of the Unabomber, but he would only come forward on two conditions. First, the government would allow his client to stay anonymous. And second, the government would not seek the death penalty. The FBI eagerly agreed to the terms, and David sat down with them for the most difficult conversation of his life to that point. And then he had to have an even more difficult conversation. David had to tell his poor mother that her older son was a mass murderer and that her younger son was the one who turned him in. There was no way he could let her find out for herself in the newspapers, and there was no easy way to do it. He said, "Mom, have you ever read any newspaper articles about the Unabomber?" And Wanda was crushed by the news. At first, she begged David not to tell anyone, but by the end of the talk, she knew that it had to happen. Ted Kaczynski was promptly arrested on April 3rd, 1996, and the government promptly reneged on its two promises to David. David Kaczynski's name was leaked to the press, and Attorney General Janet Reno enthusiastically sought the death penalty. Eventually, Ted Kaczynski pled guilty in exchange for 8 consecutive life sentences in the federal Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where, ironically, he became friends with Ramzi Youssef, the perpetrator of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber. And that's where Ted has spent every day of his life since. The brothers have had no communication since then. David still loves his older brother, and he hopes that Ted understands why he had to have that difficult conversation with the FBI. He hopes he understands why Linda had to have that critical conversation with him. And he hopes he understands the pain his mother experienced during his uncomfortable conversation with her. But somebody had to say something. This story reminds me of that tired cliche about addressing the elephant in the room. A critical conversation about an obvious problem needs to happen, but no one wants to do it. It's too painful, embarrassing, uncomfortable, and risky. But if we ignore the elephant too long, it can sometimes turn and trample us. And that's what we see in our passage this morning. So I'm going to encourage you to turn into your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 19, or you can find it on your electronic device. 2 Samuel 19. If you don't have a Bible or an electronic device where you can find the Bible, you're welcome to take out the Bible from the shelf underneath the pew in front of you. And if you turn that Bible to page 270, you'll find 2 Samuel 19. And there are also notes in your bulletin if you'd like to follow along. This is the next to last sermon on our current series of messages entitled Antihero, The Chronicles of David. And we've talked about how David's the hero of the story, kind of, but you know, he did a lot of heroic things, but he often lacked traditional heroic qualities. And try as we might to whitewash his image, the fact remains that his life was stained by blood, soaked in scandal. And last week, we saw how King David's life of violence had finally caught up to him. David's handsome and charming son Absalom organized a violent coup d'etat in an attempt to overthrow his father and take the kingdom for himself. But David's men beat back the coup, and Absalom was killed by Joab, the commander of David's army, against David's explicit command to keep Absalom safe. So David's men returned home in victory, but their jubilation is dashed when they hear about David's sorrow over the death of his son. You see, David Kaczynski knew that his brother Ted was a killer, but he was still his brother. He didn't want him to die. And though Absalom tried to overthrow David, he was still his son. And David is distraught over his death, as we read in our passage today. So let's look at 2 Samuel 19, and we're going to start in verse 1. It says this, it was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. And the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. And the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom! Oh, Absalom, my son, my son!" Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you've made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, that you would be pleased. Now therefore arise and go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." Then the king arose and took a seat in the gate, and the people were all told, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate." And all the people came before the king. So Joab sees that King David is in a very precarious situation. The kingdom is in chaos. Absalom's coup has turned a lot of people against the king, and they're trying to figure out what to do now that their leader is dead. Should they reassemble and continue to fight? Should they surrender? Will David take his revenge on all of them? And we get a better sense of the instability as we read on. Let's pick it up again in verse 8. "Now Israel had fled every man to his home, and all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hands of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, who we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why do we say nothing about bringing the king back?'" So they didn't know what to do. And Joab understands that this is no time for mourning. David needs all the political support he can get, and right now those men who had just risked their lives to save him are completely demoralized. They think that David blames them for his son's death. David has shown them no appreciation. He is so upset that his son has died that he doesn't feel like leading his people through this crisis. Everyone sees that things are going south quickly, but David is so blinded by his belief that he can't see it or he doesn't care. And so someone needs to say something. Someone needs to address the elephant. Someone needs to have a very difficult conversation with David before the elephant turns on David and tramples him. But who in the world would want to do that? Who would want to tell the grieving king to suck it up and get back to work before it's too late? Can you imagine how uncomfortable that would be? Can you imagine how risky that would be? But the conversation must happen. Somebody's got to do it. And we would think that Joab would be the last person to give some David some tough love here. After all, Joab is the one who killed his son. But Joab's the commander of the army. He's David's right-hand man. And he may be the only person David will listen to at this point. So Joab goes to David to have this critical conversation. With great boldness, he tells David how poorly he is treating those who had fought to save him. Then he tells him that what needs to happen, that he needs to put this mourning aside and go out and encourage his people and get back to work. This is not a time for emotion. This is a time for cool-headed action. And David listens. He sits down at the city gate in front of all the people, and he gets back to work. Let's pick it up again in verse 11. And King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so too to me and more. Also, if you are not commander of the army from now on in the place of Joab. And he swayed the heart of the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, return, both you and all your servants. So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. So David listened to Joab's advice, and he won back the kingdom. Joab saved the nation with this one crucial conversation. And notice that it cost him something. David realized that the nation would be more unified around Amasa as commander of the army than Joab. David needed to show everyone that disobedience to his explicit commands would not fly. David had to reassert his strength, so he promotes Amasa over Joab. And this is shocking considering Joab's loyalty. Joab saved the kingdom, after all, by having this confrontation, this crucial conversation with the king. But now it's David's turn to take the emotion out of the equation and do what it takes to save the kingdom through cool-headed action. The easy way out for Joab would have been to just shut up and let the king grieve. The easy thing for David and Linda Kaczynski would have been to just mind their own business and never speak of Ted again. But those conversations needed to happen or people would have gotten hurt. The elephant needed to be addressed, or life as they knew it would have come to a screeching halt. And that's the main point from our passage this morning. And it's in your bulletin if you'd like to write it down. The main point's this. David's walk was stunted by the talks he punted. David's walk, his spiritual walk, was stunted by the conversations he was punting down the road that he didn't want to have, that he was avoiding and putting off. Now, Jesus, our Lord, saw how avoiding these crucial conversations can stunt our spiritual lives. Look what he says in Matthew chapter 5. So if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, well, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Now, David wasn't afraid of much. David was a warrior. He could stare down giants without flinching. He could charge into battle without giving a second thought for his own safety. But David's spiritual walk was severely hampered because he just wasn't willing or able to have difficult conversations with people. David's coping mechanism for every problem was either silence or violence. When David had an affair with Uriah's wife Bathsheba and got her pregnant, as you'll remember, he did everything but directly address the elephant. He did everything but actually talk to Uriah about it. And when he couldn't trick Uriah into thinking the baby was his, well, he just had Uriah killed. It was either silence or violence. And both options mired David's life in the mud. And when the king's son Amnon raped Tamar, David said nothing to him. He just remained silent and ignored the problem. So David's older son Absalom took matters into his own hands and murdered Amnon. Like father, like son, silence turned to violence. And later, when Absalom started to stir up discontent in the kingdom, as we saw last week, David still refused to have a crucial conversation with him. David seemed incapable of having difficult, crucial, critical, uncomfortable conversations, and it severely hampered his life. And if it wasn't for people like Joab who were willing to have the difficult, crucial, critical, uncomfortable conversations with David, then it would have completely destroyed him. And to be honest, most of us aren't much better than King David in this regard, are we? If we're honest. I mean, what crucial conversations have you and I been punting down the road? Chances are the weight of that potential conversation has been weighing down your heart this morning, just as we've been talking about it, like an elephant sitting on you. And chances are that potential conversation you're trying to ignore is the very conversation that you need to have the most. If you would just address the elephant, you would feel so much relief. You could get on with your life. You could perhaps end the heartache and anguish and conflict right now. But the longer the conversation is ducked, the longer your maturation is stuck. It's time to get set free. And so our application from this morning's passage is this: don't circumvent the elephant any longer. Stop circumventing the elephant. And this is hard, right? This is a hard message. No one wants to have that difficult conversation. If doing this was easy, then we would have already done it. And some of us can't even imagine having these kind of conversations that we know we need to have because we have no idea how to go about it. But don't worry. There is a great nugget of truth hidden in the Old Testament law to help us navigate these types of conversations. But it wasn't hidden from Jesus. I want you to look at Mark chapter 12, verses 30 to 31. Jesus talking about this. And he says, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." And he says, the second most important commandment is like it. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." Now, when Jesus declared that you shall love your neighbor as yourself, he meant that in every interaction you have with someone, you should have their best interest in mind. But you know the context from which Jesus pulled this command out of the Old Testament law? Believe it or not, the context he pulled that from is having these critical, difficult, uncomfortable conversations. I want to take a look at it. Exodus chapter 19, verses 17 through 18. The law says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor." Those critical, crucial conversations. "You shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." That love your neighbor as yourself, that treating them and their best interests and minds first, the context Jesus pulled that out of was having these critical conversations, reasoning frankly with your brother. And this verse is so helpful because God commands us to stop circumventing the elephant and instead go ahead and have those difficult conversations. We are not to remain silent, but we are to reason frankly with our neighbors. But we kind of say to ourselves, "But I don't know what to say. How do I even go about having these critical conversations?" Well, it's simple. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. In any conversation, no matter how sticky and uncomfortable, just say those things that are truly in the best interest of your neighbor. And keep in mind that what's in their best interest may not be what they want to hear. Nor may it seem like it's in their best interest in the short term. But we can't worry about that. We just love them. You don't need to worry about giving a fine speech or finding the right words to get the result that you want. You just say those things that will help them in their life and nothing more. And this is what we see in Joab's crucial conversation with David, right? It was difficult, it was uncomfortable, and it hurt. And Joab didn't gain much from this conversation other than a demotion. So it's evident that everything Joab said to David was in love. It was in David's best interest. It didn't sound like love, but it was truly in his best interest in the long term. It had to happen. And so the conversation becomes a lot easier when we realize that the only thing we have to say is that which is in the best interest of our neighbor. That's what the law said. That's what Jesus said. And if it's not in their best interest, then we don't say it. We can stop calculating how we can manipulate the conversation to our advantage and really just focus on loving the person. All we do is love, and we leave the results to God. And in the process, you will be set free as well. And so everybody wins. You can move forward with your life, and you can get unstuck. So let's plug this into some possible scenarios that God may be bringing to our minds right now in our lives. One of the most common elephants we try to circumvent is the forgiveness conversation. And this might have popped into your head right away. Either you need to ask for forgiveness or you need to tell someone you forgive them. Trust me, nothing stunts our lives more than unforgiveness, but it's one of those crucial conversations that most of us simply refuse to have. It's too difficult. It's too embarrassing. It's uncomfortable. But you just can't move on in your journey without it, and neither can they. Now, don't forget to apply the principle of love. If dredging up the past will only bring pain to your neighbor, then you should not do it. You don't have a right to hurt them simply to relieve your own guilty feelings. If that's the case, just move on with the Lord, knowing that His forgiveness is enough. And it doesn't do much good to tell someone you've forgiven them if they're not asking for forgiveness. Doesn't do much good to tell someone you've forgiven them if they don't know what they've done. But asking for forgiveness and extending forgiveness almost always blesses the other party. And it will set you free as well. You see, Ted Kaczynski cut off all contact with his brother and his brother David and his mother Wanda, the only people in the world who truly loved him because of some perceived slight against him in childhood. And he was a fool, and he was a coward. But how many of us are estranged from family members and friends for much less than that? You know, we think we have moved on and, oh, it's not affecting us. But if God has brought the need to have that conversation to your mind this morning, then you haven't moved on. And if we are willing to throw away family members and happiness and well-being just because we don't want to have an uncomfortable conversation, then I'm the fool and the coward, right? Because it's worth so much more. People and relationships are so much more valuable than my own discomfort and pride. Perhaps there's another elephant that we try to circumvent, and that's the confrontation conversation. Perhaps someone has come to mind who is drinking too much, and you know you need to say something. And perhaps you know someone who is having an affair, or they're cooking the books. And you can see that they're about to walk straight into a buzzsaw in their life. But you've been punting that conversation down the road because you have no idea what to say. Well, we go back to our principle of love. You only say what is truly in that person's best interest and nothing more. Leave the results to God. Believe me, I am a firm believer in minding your own business, okay? That's my default setting. I don't like getting in people's business. But sometimes love requires me to get involved to save that person from themselves. Maybe you know someone who's in a severe funk and you're worried that they may hurt themselves. But you'll never know for sure until you have that conversation. Now, if I'm getting involved because I love the drama, or I want to feel superior, or I'm just a jerk, then I really should mind my own business. But you'll never go wrong with love. And I'm telling you, people everywhere are stuck because they're avoiding these crucial conversations. Another elephant is telling someone a hard truth. Sometimes people have to be told things that are just uncomfortable. Maybe they're doing something to offend people and they don't even know it. Maybe they're doing something to hurt you, but they're just unaware. And it's very uncomfortable to have these kind of conversations, but love requires it. It's kind of a dumb example, but many years ago, I was having lunch with a colleague of mine. And after lunch, he got up to use the restroom, and he came. We've all been in this situation. He got up to use the restroom, and he came back, and he had forgotten to zip up his pants, his fly. And since I didn't know him very well, I decided not to have that embarrassing conversation with him. But afterwards, I started to think about it a little more, and I felt awful. At some point during the day, he would look down and realize that his pants were unzipped, and the first thing he would do is feel embarrassment. He'll think about all the people he had seen since that trip to the bathroom, and he'll feel humiliated. But then he'll probably get angry. Like, why didn't any of these people say something? I mean, sure, it would have been embarrassing at the time, but it would have saved me a whole lot of embarrassment down the road. And now this is just a small, silly example. No one's life was made or broken that day. But I think you get the point. If I'm not telling someone a hard truth that is genuinely in their best interest because I don't want to be uncomfortable, can I truly say that I'm loving that person? You see, people get hurt by the issues we skirt. Another elephant we try to circumvent is asking people for things. Maybe you've been putting off a conversation with your boss for a promotion. If you really think that your promotion will be in the best interest of the organization, then you should ask for it. It's not being selfish. Maybe you've been putting off asking that girl to go out with you or to marry you. If you can think you can make her happy, then go for it. It's not being selfish. Maybe you need to ask for help, but you're too embarrassed. Maybe you need to open up to your husband or wife or a close friend about some important issue or struggle that you're having. You don't want to be a bother. But listen, you have no idea how sharing your problem might end up blessing them. Maybe they'll be able to relate. Maybe it will give them an opportunity to extend compassion, which always makes people feel good. I'm here to tell you that our souls are dying from the conversations we're denying. We need to be willing to go there with people. There's no more fascinating life than that of Abraham Lincoln, 16th president of the United States. Can you imagine how difficult America would be without Abraham Lincoln doing the things that he had done? But we almost lost Lincoln 20 years before he became president during his turbulent courtship with Mary Todd. You see, Abraham Lincoln had issues with intimacy. He had a tremendous fear of contentment. Commitment. That's the word I'm looking for. Commitment. And soon after becoming engaged to Mary, he spiraled into a tremendous depression. Lincoln desperately wanted to get married, but he was afraid, and this tension almost destroyed him. He was so depressed, in fact, that he was bedridden. He suffered from hallucinations. He openly talked about suicide, and his friends were even compelled to hide his razors. Well, you're supposed to be happy after you get engaged, not suicidal. So even Mary broke it off. How would that make you feel if you were Mary Todd? And during this dark time, there was only one thing in which Lincoln found joy and comfort, and that was in his friendship with a man named Joshua Speed. Abe and Joshua were roommates for a few years. They even slept in the same bed for a few years, and that seems strange to us. But back then, this kind of thing didn't raise any eyebrows. It seems that men had much more intimate friendships in the past than we do today. But instead of bottling up all this fear and anxiety, as we often do, Abe shared it with his friend. In other words, he went there with Joshua. He had a crucial conversation about his issues. And instead of being a burden for Joshua, it was a blessing. You see, Joshua was given the opportunity to help his dear friend, and a short time later, Abe could return the favor. You see, Joshua got engaged, and he panicked too. But in their correspondence, Abe was able to encourage his friend to stick with it, which Joshua did. Shortly after the wedding, Joshua wrote to his friend telling him how wonderful it was to finally be married, and Abe was finally convinced himself. If Joshua could overcome his fear of commitment, then he could too. He started up his courtship with Mary Todd again, and they were married soon after. And though Abraham Lincoln struggled with melancholy his entire life, he never talked about suicide again. You see, we have no idea what we are missing by dismissing these critical conversations. We have no idea the good we could do in the lives of others. We have no idea the freedom we could experience ourselves. But since our natural and long-standing default is to circumvent the elephant, we don't even realize we are stuck, nor do we see how others are hamstrung in their silence. For all his faults, and he had many, Joab was able to have these conversations, and he saved the day. But King David never learned to do this, and he spent the second half of his life spinning his wheels as a result. Listen, it's time for us to go there. I genuinely believe that most of us are only one or two crucial conversations away from real joy and freedom and peace and victory, not only in our lives, but in the lives of the people that we need to talk to. And many of you have been confronted in your hearts by one of these elephants this morning, but you're not sure what to do. Your mind's playing tricks on you. You're trying to talk yourself out of it. Well, I don't really need to have that conversation. But you wouldn't be entertaining the thought of having a difficult conversation if it didn't need to happen. So who are you thinking about this morning? What is love requiring you to tell your neighbor? How much blessing and freedom have you been missing out on? Listen, if it's on your mind right now, then that elephant is relevant. Next week is the Sunday before Easter. And it will be our 13th and final episode in this series. And we're going to see the final chapter of David's life as he prepares to hand the kingdom to his son Solomon. Now, some of us are closer to the final chapter of our lives than others, but all of us can benefit now by asking where we want to be then. So read 1 Chronicles 29 this week. Bring a friend next Sunday, and we'll finally discover if this epic story from its ending is a comedy or a tragedy. Let's pray. Lord, I just want to thank you for these good people who've gathered here today to hopefully be encouraged by the word, Lord, and the message and your scriptures. And Lord, there's probably all of us need to have some conversation with somebody that we've been kind of punting down the road. It's stunted our growth. And Lord, I know that 9 out of 10 times we just ignore it, but Lord, there might be that 10% here today who you're calling them to have this conversation. Maybe it's to ask for forgiveness. Maybe it's to warn somebody. Maybe it's to ask for help. Maybe it's to tell somebody something that will keep them from destroying themselves. And Lord, help us to put away the discomfort and the fear and everything else, realizing that all we got to say is what's in their best interest. Lord, I pray you would show that to us. Show us how we can love that person. I pray that we wouldn't worry about what we can say to manipulate them, to change, or to make things better for ourselves, but we would just focus on what is in their best interest. And that we would have those conversations, and that we would be set free. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.